Do you know what the most requested item at homeless shelters all across the country is? It's socks. I didn't know that, and when I found that out, it made me sad. But it also made a lot of sense. At homeless shelters, new clothing is in extremely high demand. This fact is the driving force behind my friends at Bombas. Bombas exists to help support the homeless community and to bring awareness to an underpublicized problem in the United States. Bombas was founded on the philosophy of donating socks to those in need. But it's evolved to go deeper into the community. The more clothing items they sell, the more they donate. As they grow, their giving and community efforts will continue to grow right alongside them. Over 40 million acts of kindness. One purchase equals one donation. How many of us just go to a big box retail store and buy name brand socks without even second guessing it? Imagine if your purchase could support people in this country who need something as basic to us as a pair of warm, comfortable socks. Folks, do me a favor and go to bombas.com. That's BOMBAS.com. Head over and insert the code COMFORT at checkout to get 20% off your first pair of socks. Bombas covers all sizes, features great designs, including their upcoming holiday collection, and you'll be making a purchase that serves a basic human right and truly helps one of the greatest efforts in our country. That's bombas.com. BOMBAS.com. Welcome back to the show, Kelly Girardi. Thank you so much for hanging out with me. I appreciate this.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, you know, when I look at your bio and what you've accomplished like thus far, the mind just reels because you've covered so much ground and you're just sort of getting started. But like, as we dive in, why don't we start this in the same way we start every conversation around here? Tell me about your education, your professional background.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so funny enough, most people are surprised to learn that I do not hold a degree in engineering or even STEM. I actually have a film degree. And, you know, that sort of non-obvious path that led me to the commercial space industry has really benefited me and given me such a wide range of perspective on how non-engineers can create impact in the industry. So I'm coming up on 10 years in the commercial spaceflight industry, although it feels like much longer. And over those years, I've held roles in policy, media, business development, operations, really wild ride. And then on the personal side, I'm a citizen scientist. So I've had the opportunity to test spacesuits and conduct NASA-supported research in microgravity as part of a suborbital research group. And along the way, I've had the privilege to build a really large science communication platform on social media. And most recently, I'm excited about the release of my first book. It's called Not Necessarily Rocket Science, A Beginner's Guide to Life in the Space Age.
Wow, that's so lots to unpack there. Now, every time I have someone on the show of your stature, I mean, every time, I always like to ask how the interest materialized for them. Because for younger folks that'll be hearing this, it's important to know. So for you, where did the interest in science begin?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, much to my chagrin, I was a late blooming space nerd. I wasn't one of those kids who grew up thinking, oh, astronaut, that's it for me.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't go to space camp. I didn't have sort of that interest level. I'm sorry to say, because now looking back, it's like, I can't wait to give those experiences to my daughter, let's say. You know, I did have the benefit of a lot of exposure to space. So I grew up on the southeast coast of Florida and in a town called Jupiter, which was perfectly named, right? I've always been on brand. But my bedroom window actually faced this little stretch of sky right over Cape Canaveral. And so looking out, I was able to bear witness to shuttle launches growing up. And, you know, I wish I had been more invested at the time, but I think I took it for granted that this was just human spaceflight was something that just existed in the backdrop of my life as a teenager. And that is very cool. But it wasn't until after college, and I graduated the same year the shuttle program retired, that it dawned on me that, you know, there really was this entire workforce dedicated to this goal for progressing humanity's footprint in the stars. And being able to meet some of the folks who were involved through the Explorers Club really opened my eyes and motivated me and just energized me to get involved myself.
Yeah. And now you're passing that knowledge, you know, and experience onto the next generation. And I love that. I think it's extremely admirable. Obviously, it's a big deal to you. I wonder if you can give me a few thoughts on why that part of what you do matters so much.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I started this book because I was thinking about the Renaissance, you know, as funny as that sounds, but I was drawing comparisons to the fact that during the Renaissance, art was just only one manifestation of this new way of thinking, right? And cultural innovation was also happening across all the different disciplines of medicine, technology, religion, politics, science, even warfare. And so similarly, engineering innovation, I believe, represents just one small slice of the space age, and that this is actually a broader cultural movement, and that our next giant leap will require the contributions of artists, engineers, and everyone in between. And so that's what I really wanted to drive home with this book, and using my career as an example of someone who was really trying to get a foot in the door and kind of coming up with this non-linear path.
Yeah. And, you know, for an outsider, for me, it's hard to pick out high points. I mean, when I look at someone like your career, like Emily Calandrelli's career, astronaut Abby, like people like of that stature and in that club, like, but one thing I really want to talk about is Project Possum, because I think that might be one of the coolest programs in the world. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So Project Possum is an incredible citizen science initiative. The original acronym is Polar Suborbital Science in the Upper Mesosphere. And it started out as a science research mission, and the intent was to study the mesosphere. It's this middling layer of the atmosphere that is actually pretty poorly understood. And the reason for that is we haven't previously had a great means of access to study it. So you can think of, you know, commercial jets fly too low, and, you know, ISS and other spacecraft in orbit fly too high. So there's really not the perfect way to access it. And the reason that the mesosphere is important to us as a place to study is noctilucent clouds form at that altitude. And those are the highest altitude clouds in our atmosphere. And scientists believe that those are sensitive indicators of human-caused climate change. And so they are really important to study and to access. However, the advent of suborbital spaceflight would provide a perfect means, that Goldilocks solution of reaching the mesosphere. And so Project Possum was born out of the idea of a suborbital citizen science mission that would take payload specialists that were trained and scientists and researchers to access that level of our atmosphere through suborbital spaceflight. Since then, it has greatly increased the number of projects that we're focused on, including a big division dedicated to bioastronautics. And that's really where I've focused my time. And so through Project Possum and the bioastronautics research, we've been able to test spacesuits in microgravity, particularly commercial spacesuits from Final Frontier Design, and to conduct other research. And one of my favorite moments, and I'm sorry, this is such a run-on answer, but I get so excited by the opportunity to talk about it. But one of the coolest moments for me in the program was getting to test. We partnered with the Canadian National Research Council and to do parabolic flight, microgravity flights. And one of the experiments we were testing was from a Canadian space agency. It was called Biomonitor. And it was a smart garment designed to be worn on the space station by astronauts while they were exercising to be able to track their core vitals and to get some of that biometric data. And so I had the opportunity to test that under a spacesuit in microgravity and, you know, doing push-ups and all of these sort of acrobatics in zero G weightless.
Wow.
Was just so exciting. And then a few weeks later, the experiment actually launched to the International Space Station with CSA. So it was very exciting to be able to provide some data validation and contribute to something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll have links to Project Possum in the show notes for tonight's episode. I definitely want to touch on your book. You mentioned it at the top of the show. Why did you feel like it was important to write this book, not necessarily rocket science?
I thought it was important because it's a resource that I wish I had had when I was starting out.
Yeah.
You know, I think imposter syndrome is something that I hear so many people talk about and experience. And for me, it was just all encompassing in the beginning of my career because I really was questioning whether or not there was a place for me in the industry as a non-engineer.
Yeah.
And I think that it took me quite a few reps to figure out that the answer was yes, absolutely. Not only is there a place, but we need those diverse skill sets and perspectives, and that, you know, we won't be able to accomplish our goals if we don't have that multitude of skill sets in this industry.
Right.
And so I wanted to make sure that I was capturing that for anyone else who might be questioning whether there's a place, and then taking it a few steps further, tactical steps, how to get involved.
It's interesting. Again, going through your website, like doing research for this, you have a fashion line that actually just drop not too long ago. Tell me about that. That's remarkable, man. How did that happen for you?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Speaking of multitudes, it's one of the things that has also always captivated my interest is fashion. So space and fashion have been the two things that I really enjoy. And so the thought of combining them was very exciting to me. And I noticed a gap in the market for women like me who really are enthusiastic about space and science and want to showcase that in a way that feels authentic to us and also combines interests. So, you know, you'll notice some of the slogans are a little bit funny in the sense that they reference movies like Mean Girls, for example. I have one popular one that's a bestseller that says, "Get in, loser, we're going to space," riffing off of Mean Girls. So things like that, that really just allow people to embrace their multitudes, especially women in STEM.
You know, this is a really important one I want to ask you about. I want to ask you about compartmentalization. Because when you have as much on your plate as you do, I imagine it can be an immediate challenge to be able to divide your time, you know, so that you can give 100% of yourself to every venture, every interest. I mean, how do you do that?
Yeah, I really am ruthless with my time prioritization and compartmentalizing. Like you said, my calendar is color-coded and indecipherable by anyone but myself, but I understand exactly how it works. I lean on that greatly. I also really follow David Allen's two-minute rule, as he coined. The idea is if there's any task that comes across your plate that you can accomplish in 2 minutes, do it right then and there, and don't let it linger on a to-do list. Do what you can, and then set aside time that's explicitly dedicated to resolving it if it's longer.
Yeah.
And so I do have a balance of different things. I have work, I have my interests, and then I have my hobbies, and I have these side ventures. And then of course I have my family. I have a very active 3-year-old daughter who demands and deserves so much of my attention. And so I really do take care to make sure that each week my days are very tightly scripted.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, and it's funny, I wanted to ask you too, you know, we just wrapped this Amelia Earhart project, over 100 podcasts, and there's a documentary that's in distribution discussion right now for it. So we're excited about that. I've talked to hundreds of women in various STEM fields over the last several years, and almost everyone cites Earhart in some manner for paving the way, like in the 30s, you know, for modern, before STEM was even STEM. She didn't know that was going to happen. When you look at like icons of the past, like Earhart and others, people that kind of came before you, what does their example say to you? Like, how do we use their example to help sort of full steam ahead?
No, it's a great question. And I think about this a lot. You know, I think about women like Jerry Cobb, who, you know, prior at the same time that, you know, America's first astronauts, the Mercury 7, were training, you know, she in parallel and another group of extraordinary women, 13 altogether, they were called the Mercury 13, were also training in parallel. This was before women were eligible to become astronaut candidates, but they were out there proving and insisting that women did have the right stuff. And I think it's just a great room. And of course they did. Jerry in particular took her fight all the way to Congress and testified on behalf of, you know, the inclusion of women in the astronaut corps. It would take more years, unfortunately, but, you know, she and her colleagues equaled or outscored their male peers in the tests. And so it was just a great determination and perseverance. And to me, it's a reminder that whatever we want to see achieved or accomplished requires persistence. And it is a fight. You do have to go after it because it's not always a guarantee that it's just going to fall in your lap as an opportunity.
Yeah.
And so I think it really is important to carve out. And it's something that I've taken to heart in carving out my own path to spaceflight, right? I started late in the game, you know, I had a lot of catching up to do. I'm not an engineer. I did know that I wanted to achieve spaceflight myself in my life. And so for me, that required carving a workaround path. And thinking, okay, chances are slim that I'm going to be a NASA astronaut candidate because of the education choices, degree choices, and career choices I've made thus far and where I am right now. How can I get there from a different way?
Yeah.
And so to me, that was the citizen science route. It was going out, not only joining a program, but jumping in and helping spearhead different initiatives and becoming a leader within the program and helping define it and advance it and contribute to it so that it could become the stature that would help all citizen scientists come into space from a different angle.
As we wrap up tonight, and kind of before we get out of your way, I know you got a lot going on. There's obviously a lot of serious discussion regarding the inhabitation of Mars. You know, the idea that it's no longer fantasy, you know, this is inevitable. I'm sure the most obvious question has now become when. So I'll ask you that. Do you think in our lifetime a human being will ever step foot on Mars?
I do. I have to say yes. And, you know, it's what excites me most is that this is no longer as much of an engineering challenge, although it is an enormous engineering challenge, the most advanced ever undertaken. But it's more of an economic challenge right now. And I think that that is the shift, you know, that makes all the difference, because we now have not only government, but also private industry interested in making this happen. And so we have a force multiplier, both of talent and of engineering prowess, you know, and public will. And I think that combination is a really powerful one to get us there. Timelines, I think they're probably almost worse than political polling in the space industry. It's just, you know, you can throw a dart on the board in terms of timelines and funding cycles. But I will say, I think it's absolutely achievable. I think it's, you know, I marvel at the fact that we're at the point now where the giggle factor of this is removed and that we can actually, you know, conceive of this happening within our lifetimes. And I really am desperate to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. Kelly, before we get out of here tonight, can you plug the book, The Fashion Line? Where can people follow you on Twitter? All that jazz.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am available at Kelly Girardi on all platforms, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, you name it, I'm on it. In links in those platforms, you'll see a link tree that has a link to my book. My book is available on shelves at Barnes & Noble and other bookstores, on Amazon.com. And The Fashion Line is linked in my bio in all of my social media platforms.
Fantastic. The book is Not Necessarily Rocket Science, A Beginner's Guide to Life in the Space Age. Kelly, this was an absolute honor. Thank you so much. I know you're slammed. I know you got a lot going on. So thanks for carving out a little time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Chris. No, it was a delight to be on. And thank you so much for having me.
If you made it all the way through our conversation tonight, I want to thank you for hanging out with me and my friends. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media as we post each new conversation as they air. News, show information, and more. Go to facebook.com/meandmyfriendspod. On Twitter, you can search the handle meandmyfriendspod. And on Instagram, search the handle @meandmyfriendspod. If you've enjoyed our conversation tonight, please do me a favor and head to iTunes and rate us and leave us a review. As a brand new podcast, we need all the help we can get, and your time is appreciated. Me and My Friends is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. The opinions on Me and My Friends are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Inc. Chris Evan Films, Inc. is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. Any audio clips used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of education and entertainment, and no infringement is ever intended. Me and My Friends is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films, Inc. and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films, Inc. All rights reserved. Me and My Friends is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2020. All rights reserved.